We made this.
Welcome everyone to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. I am your host Kurt North and welcome to the continuing coverage of Season 2 of Millennium. We are just now 5 episodes away from the finale and joining me today is returning guest Adam Silver.
How are you, Kurt?
I'm all right. I'm not too bad. I was just going to get into the whole COVID situation at the moment to see how you were doing over there. We're currently in lockdown. So I'm keeping well, but the lockdown restrictions currently in the UK are quite tight. We can only go out for 4 reasons, and so things like going out for shopping, medicine. Going to vulnerable people and for work if only work's possible. So is that where you are at the moment then?
Yeah, so I'm going at work. We're going back and forth. So like 1 week we're in the office, the other week we're at home. So I've been home this past week. So this week I'll be going into the office. So not looking right. Too forward to it, but but it is, it is what it is. But yeah, same here in Texas. We're can only go out for certain reasons. Although I guess there is talk here of opening up some businesses, but schools are still going to be closed through the end of the school year. So
we've literally just today had our education secretary on the podium because we're currently in lockdown for at least another 3 weeks. And the educational secretary says there's no date on when schools will go back. But we'll see how that transpires. But and of course, you know, with this being a Millennium podcast, we're certainly going to be delving into a bit more into kind of plagues and the like as we get into the season. But what have your thoughts been of the second season as a whole, and how the podcast has you helped? Have you been rewatching it with the podcast as well?
I haven't been able to rewatch it, but yeah, season 2 is very good. It's very consistent. I mean, I think probably everything has been. Everybody on the has really enjoyed it, whether they've seen it before many times or whether they're just now watching it. So, I mean, probably maybe the latter half of season 1, but season 2 is probably the most consistent period of Millennium as far as the good episodes and consistent writing and everything. So, and consistent themes throughout the season. So, I mean, my opinion is as high as most people's.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are talking about a season 2 episode, of course. As I said, at the top there, we're 5 episodes from the end of season 2. We are obviously going to continue on with season 3, but that's later in the year. So we'll be having a break towards the end of the season here. But we're looking at episode 18 of season 2, which is In Incardio Ego, which was written by Chip Johansson and directed by Thomas J. Wright. And this week's episode features a prison break and an immaculate conception. And Adam, before we go into depth in this episode, actually, what would you rate this particular episode, and what are your initial thoughts on it before we're going any deeper into the episode itself?
I actually think this is a very solid episode. I enjoyed it a bit, so I would probably give it an 8.
Is there a reason for that? Is there anything that particularly jumps out, any theme or part or the way Frank's portrayed or anything like that works for you?
Well, it actually reminds me of a bit of the Wild and the Innocent, which I think is a good episode from season 1. It's it's really similar in a few ways. I mean, you're tracking these people who are, you know, they're obviously concerned about their pregnancy, their child that's coming, and you see Frank's empathy with the characters and his concern of wanting to not just find them, but make sure that they're protected as well. So, as I said, I think it's a very, very solid episode.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this one I gave last week. I know you won't have heard last week's yet because I haven't edited yet for a start off. So I spoke to Russ a few
days
ago.
I don't know how you do all these podcasts. Your machine.
Trust me. There's lots of late nights, but dedicated for the shows that I love as well. You know, being the X-Cast and Millennium are both two of my favorite shows, as well as Star Trek as well. Which ironically does have a similar title in the new Star Trek Picard, which is Et Incardia Ego, which wasn't lost on me.
I saw the first thing I thought of was the Millennium episode.
Exactly. It was the first thing when myself and Tony. We're going through the episodes and they announced that it was like, oh, and to be fair, we've got some backstage stuff that we do. And because I'm recording this one and we're recording Et Incardia Ego, I kept getting the ones mixed up. I kept clicking in the wrong thing. So, which is unusual. But I gave last week's 6.5 to 7 out of 10. And I'd probably give this episode the same. Although before...
I rate things higher. I rate things pretty high. So,
yeah,
we may not be too far apart in what we think. Just the rating might be different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I tend to and Russ Hugo, who I spoke to on it last week, rates very. He actually rates from 0 to 10. So his episodes will have things like there could be a 2. Whereas I'm very similar to an IMDb score, and I think you are as well. It's more of a 6 to 10 kind of thing. So.
Yeah, my average for Millennium is probably like 7.5 or for 8, or at least for like something like season 2. So I mean, this, as I said, they're pretty consistent, solid. So I give it pretty decent score.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing for this one for me is that it would rate towards the bottom half of the season overall. But then that's no offense to the actual episode, because it's season 2 is so strong. Last week was Siren, and as much as I reappreciated Siren, I didn't remember too much about it before my rewatch. Whereas this one was one that instantly jumped out. If I was to think of season 2 episodes,
yeah, I remember the basic plot of this one and what happened before I rewatched it a little while ago. So
putting the two together, looking at this one back to back, especially because I've literally recorded them days apart. That they're very similar level to me. They're still very good. They're still, you know, up there. The issue that I have with both of these is that they feel sometimes like Siren felt like two stories in one. This one feels like it's a bit too on the nose on occasion. So,
yeah,
I would say, for example, the relationship of Sonny and Jeanette, I think, is done really well. We'll get into that in a bit later detail. But the portrayal of the town folk, the portrayal of the guards and the wardens and the police and even Frank to a degree. But we'll talk about this when we get into the deeper characterization. There is an issue that I do have with that. So In Incardia Ego got 7.3 out of 10, actually. It got 205 votes. So rated fairly high again. I think that the lowest was 6.8, and that was for A Single Blade of Grass, I believe. But I was saying to this on last episode, I think it ends up being around the fifth, sixth, seventh lowest of the season, which I would say is probably fair. Let's look at In Incardia Ego in more depth. Okay, so the teaser starts with a women's prison where a guard turns up to the prison cell. Jeanette's looking to seduce a guard, albeit in an attempt to escape the prison. The teaser is fairly straightforward until the prison guard, who's been stripped off his clothes, shoots at Jeanette and remarkably hits a prison badge, which effectively saves her life. What did you think to this teaser? Do you think it works as a good way of setting it up and both setting up Sonny and Jeanette's character, the fact that Sonny actually does beat the guard up, and eventually, as we find out, dies. But this is where automatically, straight away, meaning a bit, they're a bit cartoonish. It's a bit on the nose with what's happening here. But what did you think as the teaser as a general, as the prison break unfolds?
Right. I mean, you're set up with the prison guards not exactly being the greatest people, so it's mm-hmm. not too hard to, you know, see them get beat up and not care too much about them. But I mean, I think it's a decent teaser. It sort of, you know, not completely sets up, you know, what's going on between Jinhead and Sunny just yet, but I think it's okay. It's not the greatest teaser, but it works.
The teaser itself is in some ways portrays quite a solid start without giving away too much, and I think that it does that for the reason of, you know, when we do get to the scene where the gunshot has been shot and it hits the badge, and then you obviously see that the image within the bullet, it gives you a like, oh, hang on, what's that about? Then you've got the flip side of actually Sonny actually beating the guy to death and going full on, which we'll find out the reasons for.
Right.
Reason for shortly. But I think it's really interesting that they do it that way. I think the opening scene, the very opening scene with the guard and Jeanette is I think it's quite done quite tastefully and quite interestingly, the way that they actually design that. And we don't necessarily see the cartoonish at that point. It's kind of like, oh right, it's just a single guard. It's something we might have seen in the X-Files before.
Yeah.
And you can kind of forgive that. I think it's the build up of other things. Like we get to the second guard and the second guard's still a bit the same. There is a couple of things as we come out the teaser though, isn't there? Because we see that I think it's the warden, he didn't who was actually Aurelius Belt, isn't he, from Space, episode Space.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah. The warden didn't report he had an authorized weapon in his ankle holster there, and he says that was a way to hide the fact, you know, because of obviously the death payout and stuff wouldn't have paid out if he had an authorized weapon. That was an interesting little detail to put in there, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, you know, it establishes in this episode that, you know, there's an attempt to protect, you know, these prison guards, even when they're not doing exactly what they should. So, I mean, it's sort of a similar thing to cops protecting their own. So you see that similar dynamic here.
Yeah, well, I think that you're right. There's a lot of protectionism goes on through this episode, actually, isn't there? There's also the scene later on where Frank is he's wanting to speak to the guards, and the warden's saying, you know, one of them has raped somebody.
Right.
And he says, well, the 47 aren't, 47 aren't, haven't done that. And he's getting very protectionist over that. And also and it's only just kind of dawned on me now where we get to the local police and doing the search for the two girls that obviously that have escaped. There's a particular scene there where they cock all the weapons, and Frank's like really deeply sized, doesn't he? And he's like, you know, what, why, you know, he's like, oh, don't, you know, don't do this. They're completely over egging what's gone on. It's almost like a Rambo thing at that point. Yeah. So I think that is interesting. I didn't really think about that until right now, where obviously someone has died. They don't know that. We obviously do.
I think Frank is skeptical. He seems skeptical from the start of these are, you know, just bad people that need to be caught. He seems interested into the beating of the guard wasn't necessarily to kill him. It was protection. So he figures these things out pretty quickly. Although I'm not quite sure why he's investigating this. I'm not sure why Frank is brought into this case. Did you get that sense of what he's there for?
Yes and no, because I think that we later find that when Peter comes into the cell, I think it's interesting when he says it's something along the lines of, we can pull you out if you need to. And, you know, and this is I think this will be the first time that they've seen each other, because I don't necessarily think, I can't remember much in Siren of them really having anything to do with each other. So this is the first one since Roosters. So, you know, we've had all the big argument in Roosters, Owls and Roosters, about what the Millennium Group are and what they're doing. And obviously we've had the death of the old man, and and the kind of the reconciliation in that point, and the, you know, we've talked about on Owls and Roosters about the reconciliation of the family unit, and there's a path forward for Frank now, with the death of the old man, and where Peter's sort of seen his things, he's let them down. But this is the first time that we really see him. And towards the end of the episode, Peter does have the file, and the file does have a Millennium Group symbol, the Ouroboros, on the actual folder. So the way that I see, and it's something I was going to touch upon later, but we can touch upon it now, is that Frank seems to have been given this case, and it happened over the course of season two, by the group, because they say, you know, the same monster, for example, they get offered the case, and it's all to do about find the evil Frank, and it's all about, you know, obviously the girl. And there's a few episodes like that where the Millennium Group seem to like just say go investigate, and I think this is another one where it's like, you know, they want to go and investigate, because the way that Peter closes the door at the very end of the episode in the car is almost like that's the job done and it's sealed off. And then there's the whole issue of what Frank has to follow the path, and it's not really their path that they're following. It's Frank's following the path to get this baby to those couple at the end. That's the way that I saw it. But you're right with the Millennium Group.
That makes sense in the broader season. Like individually in the episode, I wasn't sure if this was something brought to Frank by the Millennium Group or not, and whether Peter just followed him there. So
yeah,
it wasn't entirely clear to me.
It's not clear. Absolutely, it's not clear. And I'm just kind of inferring, just from the couple of things that were said within the episode, that it could potentially, or the way that I read it was that they have been asked to come into this. And there is this element of, you know, of what's happening with the girls. So the two girls that were chased around anyway, they were wearing the prison uniforms, and they were lucky not to get killed by the gun-happy police officers on there, because it was very kind of like, you know, what they're doing. And after that, we kind of move into the scene that I've just been talking about, actually, the one where we've got Peter come into the cell. And I thought this was really interesting, and really would like to get your thoughts on this, because Frank is kind of saying he's getting a picture of what this unit is now, and what has happened, because Sonny is painted as by Frank as a victim, because she would only ever cross into violence when there seemed to be another one in harm's way. For example, you know, the stepfather abusing the younger sister, or the child that was involved. And in this case, it's Jeanette. So Frank's also says that she's been beaten since the day she was born. Now, he I don't know if he's reading that from the records, or he's just inferring that he's understands her pathology in some ways. But I really thought that that's really crucial to the episode. How did you view that, and the way that Sonny is painted?
You know, the warden is very much approaching Sonny as, you know, just a barbarous person who, you know, would beat someone to death on, you know, without thinking about it. But, you know, Frank is sort of automatically skeptical of that. And then looking into the history, he sees that, no, she really only acts out in violence when she's being threatened, or somebody she loves is being threatened. So he instantly takes another attack on her and what her motivations might be.
Do you think that this within this episode that you this was an argument that Russ and I were talking about recently, that this is an episode that could have easily have included Catherine in it? Would you have liked to have seen that?
Yeah, I guess it could have. I mean, any opportunity to use Catherine, because Catherine's kind of sidelined in the season, that may be one of its, you know, one of the cons of the season. But I can see that now, that since you have the abuse angle and the maybe bringing her in. But I think probably the thinking here was that it's a prisoner chase sort of episode. It's kind of built around that sort of that action, so maybe that's why they keep the empathy with Frank and with the characters, you know, their bond. So maybe they just didn't think that they needed any more emotional point of view or drama, human drama with Catherine in it.
As you mentioned, I mean, things like the well-worn lock and the innocent, the wild and the innocent as well from last season, that this could almost be like reconstituted into season one in a lot of ways.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it could be a season one episode.
You're right with the wanting to keep it chasing, because it does feel, I mean, we go from, it's very kind of straightforward in its plotting, is that, you know, apart from the stuff that we'll get into, but, you know, it's women break out of prison, they go on the run, they end up in hostage negotiation, and the episode is resolved. So it's a very kind of straightforward, and I was thinking about this today, that there's a fair amount to talk about, but not so much that, you know, there's just elements rather than anything major, because it's just literally, as you say, more of a thrill chase. I think Mark Snow's score really kind of pushes that as well.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't think there's a lot of layers to this episode. I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
So they are circling this house, as Jeanette feels that they are destined to be there as well. The house that we eventually find out is where the baby's going to end up. So this is the first time. It's very much like when we see them first time, it's very much like, you know, they're not there. They don't happen to be in the house at that point. The path wasn't meant for them at this point. This is the way that I was reading it, that it wasn't ready. That house wasn't ready for them. That wasn't for them. It was for the baby. It wasn't for them. And the path was eventually for Frank to go down that level. We get the scenes within the actual motel room as well, where we find that the guy's been from that house, well, near that house, has been arrested. Not arrested, has been kidnapped by the couple. And we find out just how much that they love each other. What did you think to the portrayal of the two girls here? Because obviously it's a lesbian couple that's being portrayed in late 90s TV. How did you view that?
I think pretty well. I mean, I think that you get, you know, as you mentioned, this was the 90s, so you don't see maybe as much, you know, physical affection and stuff that you might see now, or you probably would see nowadays. But I think that it is made up for by the emotional bond that you see between the two. I mean, I think that really carries the episode. The two actresses do really well. In my mind,
yeah, I personally think it's the strongest part of the episode. I think that that those two hold this episode together, both in their acting, in the characterization that's being built up into them. Because Jeanette's very much, in some ways, otherworldly. She's not quite with us. She's not quite on this plane. And they start talking about right towards the end of the episode, where they're in the freight train. They start talking about how she didn't say a word in prison, that she's been brought out of her shell, that she's been abused that much, that, you know, it's taken her that long to come out, and that Sonny was her, you know, was her, like, sort of, you know, what made her come out of her shell, and, you know, and then the great love that's between them. And Frank sees that, like, right away. And I think that, to be fair, in around the late 90s, that's something that you probably wouldn't have seen that much of at all, the way it's portrayed in this one. And I think that's, as I say, is the strongest part of the show for me. I think this really did work, you know, and, you know, and it's done in a way that, you know, what's the word? It's done in a way that's, it doesn't dwell on it. It doesn't make a point of it. The only issue that people could see it is that they both end up being killed. But the story isn't necessarily about that in my eyes. But I can see people detracting from it from that point of view.
Yeah, no way does it come off as you know, punishing a lesbian couple, yeah, or something. I mean, it doesn't come off that way. It comes off as a more natural end to the story. As I said, they're portrayed very well. And yeah, when you think about it, this must have, I wasn't really on chat rooms or anything back then, so I don't know whether this was very controversial with fans or not. But I mean, you have to, probably so, that this was maybe pushing the envelope for back then.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there, and I think I would agree with that. It's not punishing them in any way, because, you know, it is an immaculate conception from what we understand it to be, that she's died from childbirth, and that that Sonny has died because, you know, she can't go on. She loves her so much more that she can't see herself living through that. And they're both, as well as being homosexual, they're also both really abused characters in their own right. There's a reason why they're in jail, because they've been stuck in this cycle of abuse that we've talked about in season one. You know, there's this personal apocalypse kind of aspect that Darren Mooney talks about, that, you know, it's all everyone's personal apocalypse. So there is that element to it, but this one's got a bit more hope in it, which I think is really interesting that they've gone down this far down this season to start at least giving us a bit of a hope in a story rather than being completely dark.
I suppose you could see it as maybe problematic that it's two abused women that have been abused by men that have gotten together, but I don't think that was the intent of the episode. No. I don't get that sense that's what that was about, of explaining their relationship or something. I think that their relationship is one of love and that would have happened regardless of anything else. They just happened to meet in prison. You know, that just happened to be where they came together.
As I say, I think that the heart of the episode for me is them two. And I think with lesser actors, I don't think it would have worked quite as well. I think that they've really thought about them as characters, which is really good. That, you know, the protectionism is actually used as a good narrative point. That, you know, as we see from the beginning, the very first part of the episode, we see her bludgeon somebody, but when Frank says that she would only go that far when she's protecting somebody, when she's protecting the baby, when she's protecting her child, when she's protecting her sister, that they've really thought about that. The way that, as I say, Jeanette kind of comes across as more otherworldly, because she's almost like being guided on instinct and, you know, from a higher power or whatever that may be. But there's definitely some sort of something at work, at play, that's controlling her to a degree.
Yeah, I think Sunny is just trusting her, trusting what she's saying, and just sees it as her role to protect her. And because it is mentioned that Sunny was just a couple of months away from getting out of prison, but well, why would she do this now? You know, when she was a few months away. So that was another thing that showed him that there was more going on here.
The story, I think there's a lot going for this, more to think about. The story is really, really strong. The thought about what they wanted to do and what they wanted to put in, and the things that wanted to keep you off kilter or quite keep you on your toes in such, you know, because we are looking at a height. It's kind of like, obviously, the fugitive thing. It wasn't me kind of thing. Sonny's doing this out of protection, and we don't want people killing people, and she would have to atone for that. There is a couple of other things as well which really work to the story, and I think that helps to ramp up the stakes. And the clinic is one of them. I think the way that they use the, when they walk into the clinic, that you get people looking at them with a bit of like, oh, what are these? Who are these two? But you also get the newspaper. She doesn't see the front page just yet, but when she eventually does, that kind of builds up that urgency with the story, you know, that the net might be getting closer, tighter on them. But also it gives them that ability to bring in the fact that there's danger to the issue as well, because of obviously we find out that, you know, she may well bleed out. She needs to go to hospital if she does give birth. And having the two like collide at this point, that, you know, that Sunny's really concerned, she's trying to protect her. You could read the doctor line as either they're aware that they're looking for these two people, or I'm going to get the doctor because you are in serious danger of being ill when you had the baby.
Yeah, I think it's the latter. So, that was my interpretation. Yeah.
But I quite like the slight ambiguity there. I would go the same as you. I think that was the reason for it. But what did you make to that? Because that's a bit where we slow down a little bit, that we do feel that, you know, it's an everyday occurrence that people are going into a clinic to check in on the baby, to be able to see the baby and to see how it's getting on and stuff. But with it gives us just a step to breathe a little bit in this, because this is an episode that goes quick. But then it also gives us the flip side and raises the stakes ready for the final act.
Right. I mean, I think it helps establish things a bit more before you get to the sort of action of the episode. So just the care and concern they have for each other and for the baby. And, you know, then obviously they find out that, oh, the prison guard died, so they have to, they're in much bigger trouble than they maybe thought they were. So, but yeah, this is another part that just establishes the characters.
When the cleaner finds the kidnapped man in the back of the bathroom and we bring him into the interrogation, the way that, you know, Frank says, are you just looking to get lucky? that to me is like, we've already had the prison guards, we've already had the two prison guards, we've already had the police overreacting, and now we're getting this on top of, which is a build up of, you know, these either being misogynistic or they're being predatory, as what he's alluding to here. And they're obviously scared that the wife's going to find out and stuff like that, that the warden is particularly guarded as well over his people. And we'll get into Schiffer in a minute. Do you feel that that worked? And I think it's a good question to ask about Frank, is that Frank kind of resorts back to a season one version of Frank as well, that he's the altruist in some ways. He's the one that is the one that's going to be right, the one that has absolute resolution in what he's saying, that he's the guiding light about, among all this murk and horribleness and evilness around him.
Yeah, he's the only really good person here. Because, like you said, all the other characters are, not sympathetic in some way, or if not revolting. And it's definitely maybe unnecessary for them all to be that way. But yeah, Frank is just basically disgusted by most of the people that he meets in this episode. So yeah, he has no time for them, no sympathy for them.
I don't think he's ever been in an episode where I've seen more a dichotomy of two different things, that Frank is so far pushed back into season one territory that he's almost in some ways more altruistic and more feeling and empathic about people, and and really wanting to look after these two escaped prisoners, which is what Frank can do, but his attitude towards everyone else. But then the other side of things is that he's got so many people around him, which brings me to the Schiffer interview, that it's not often I scream at a television, and this guy was just absolutely revolting in every utter of the word. Do you think it was right to include the way that his attitude was? And do you think that having that reaction that I had, the fact that, especially when he says that she was a dyke, that was really interesting, that actual phrase. It was supposed to be a joke, for example, which is absolutely absurd. But, and I'm surprised they got away with it, actually, to be honest, because that does raise so much anger in personally in myself.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a disgusting character, and I think it makes the point that he had done something like, something to a female prisoner before, and he was transferred. So again, you have that, protecting their own theme, where, he didn't get punished for what he did. He just got transferred to another location, which, again, you may have something like that too much in this episode, but maybe they were just trying to show that point, maybe that, these prison guards are maybe not held accountable for the things they do, and that the people in these prisons are at risk of, getting abused by them. So to your earlier point about Frank, I don't know, maybe that's something that Chip Johannesson saw from season one that he wanted to continue, that maybe he had a different, more of the season one view of Frank than Glenn Morgan and James Wong did. So
yeah, and of course he'll go on to season three as well, won't he, which we won't talk about, he goes to do quite a few episodes in season three, so no doubt we'll talk about Chip Johannesson in more detail. I know that Darren spoke to me about Force Majeure. I can't think of any ones other than that off the top of my head now, but yeah, it is interesting that that Chip Johannesson has his dream logic aspect to him, and you do get a touch of this in here actually, because you do get some of the themes which we'll touch upon right at the very end of the episode, and we'll park that for now. But the one thing that I felt, the fact that Frank was going on his own quite a lot as well, that he was he went to the house, for example, and the police felt out of the loop. And to be fair, I don't have any issues with that, because of the way the police were, that I could see him going off on his own and looking into this. But they do find out that they were right at the end of the day, that they're not going to go back to that house, because that's been given away, because Frank has seen them at the house now. They've gone back to the house again, and Frank arrives there, sees the follow the path, So it's actually his story that we're following here, because this way it like threads in for me that, you know, he was meant to see the house, he was meant to see that painting, he was meant to see the follow the path signs and stuff like that. So he was the one that's going down that path. And you know, and but the Sonny and Jeanette were all being guided, especially Jeanette were being guided, and Sonny was obviously the protector in that. But it was that the police felt out of the loop, and as I say, I'm not surprised by that. And they do it again with the freight train as well, that they don't tell the police where they were going. When we do get to the freight train area, we see that they are right, that they are going to skip town because of what Frank did, effectively. That's at the end of the day, police and Frank are both right. They're not going to go back there because that's done now. We see that Sonny picks up on Frank when she's in the freight train and goes around the back. When Frank is trying to sort of talk his way out of it, he mentions about the rape and stuff. And we see that side of Sonny again, don't we? We see that protectionism side of her. He said, don't tell her. Again, that really feeds into her character, doesn't it, really?
Yes, yeah, of course. And you know, again, she's not wanting to kill Frank, but she's willing to do so if she has to, because she's so protective of Jeanette and the child.
And what I actually do particularly like as well, we don't see much of Sonny in the way of a religious person, apart from this one scene where she shows the bullet and it's God's child. Don't say that to her, you know. But you get the feeling that she can actually believe that it was the prison guard. It might not be, but she's doing that protection thing, doesn't she? So
yeah, I think that she's not the religious one. That she's probably, you know, someone who has dealt with abuse and the realities of the world. She's probably been cynical about those sort of things, but she believes in Jeanette, and that's the only thing she really cares about. I don't think she cares about what exactly the circumstances are. She just cares about protecting them. She just sees that as her mission.
For the police to catch up, we need the police to be there to create this hostage negotiation scene. So we need a MacGuffin to do that. And obviously, Frank and Peter find out that where they worked in the file, and the file's left on the desk, and the police find that. It's interesting that the guy says that onto the minds of two crazy ass freaks, that's gotta hurt. And for me, I see that as him talking about Frank and Peter.
But yeah, that's interesting. That's not something I caught.
Yeah, it's because I thought that, you know, because you can take it both ways. You can take it as they're talking about Sonny and Jeanette. But I personally took it as them, you know, how, you know, trying to get into the minds of them to work out what they're doing now. So so that's the way that I read that scene anyway.
And of course, the police aren't, you know, they don't care about the situation. They just want to put them down. So they're not interested in having any empathy here for the you know, that's yeah. Instead, Frank is the only one here that cares about them. That he's the loner here in that part of the episode. So, which, you know, I mean, it makes for the drama. It makes for the stakes. So that's okay.
Well, we do get to this negotiation scene. I thought the setup was quite nice. It had very kind of an X-File feel to it. I mean, only purely because, you know, we're on a rail track and it's very reminiscent of 731 and stuff like that. And it felt like that. It's some of the scenes, some of the direction on it worked really well. The way they're pulling out when the police got there and things like that was good.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a well done hostage scene, action scene.
Yeah, and what it's also done effectively as well. Although I cannot believe that a nurse would actually do this and actually let slip out about the rape. We were told what that horrible man's done to you, which I thought was like, oh, okay. I understand they have to do that, but it did feel a bit forced to me in that way. But at the same time, it still had the propulsiveness. And, you know, these scenes are quite long. We get like, you know, there's a good 15 minutes sort of dealt with this. And, you know, there's simple things like Frank being tied up, and then eventually, you know, he offers to help, and he, you know, like Mulder does in Dwayne Barry, for example, it says step away from the thing because they might shoot you, and, you know, but it's the same kind of, you know, kind of tropes that you would get in a negotiation, that the person inside knows more details than the people outside. In this case, it's more he knows that they're trigger happy. He doesn't want them to die. He wants to protect them. When the paramedics come up, who are obviously police officers, as we know that from the way it's filmed, but he actually tells Sonny to just take the medical supplies, and eventually we get Frank being released and the gun coming out. And I thought the gun coming out was a really nice scene as well. What did you make of that?
I think that's set up well.
Yeah, and I think then moving on from that, really, it's the rest of the scene kind of plays out as it would. But what did you make to the direction of the freight train? This is something I was going to pick up on because of the theme of the episode. What did you make to the filming of the internals of the freight train?
I mean, I think everything in the scene works. I mean, everything. Yeah, I think the imagery is purposeful. That it's meant to be sort of a nativity of sorts for the birth. As you said, maybe some things in the episode are too on the nose, but
I think that works. Though I do think that works personally. The love that they're sharing between them. That Frank's obviously there, and she pleads with him, to basically make sure that the baby's looked after, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I think that the way that it's pulled together, that these three people do actually care, have empathy for each other. That obviously the two of them love each other. But Frank's got massive empathy at this point.
And of course, we see that the baby is white. Maybe the rape wasn't the the explanation here, after all.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point that they showed that, because I think they did need to show that.
And then Peter, of course, gets the report.
It's very nice the way they do that, though, because she's saying some of the questions that are asked, which I think is really pertinent to the episode as well, is that why would God want to waste his time on two people like us? And during that scene, it says people won't believe this, and all this. It's very kind of ethereal and very kind of moving, and the music does really well to do that. And as you say, the scene with Peter, with the actual tests to show that there's no known father, in the way that the tests run, the biological tests, but the music's playing over and she's talking over the top of it again, similar to the Wild and the Innocent. Where she talks, I know it's slightly done different there because the way it's done there is more that she's talking to Frank in the prison cell. But here we're getting more of she's talking just before she dies. As why would God choose us? Why would they do that? Would people really believe that? Is kind of the theme of it. Would it be it can't be immaculate conception. And we emphasize that by, as you say, seeing Peter's results there. And then we get the finale is they get Frank kind of sitting there with holding the baby. Jeanette's obviously died, and then Sonny goes out and says, I love you more, which has been said twice over the course of the rest of the episode. What do you think of her decision to go out, though? Because there was something about them, there was some sort of intimation that they were not right for this world as well, that they weren't born, they shouldn't have been really born into this world, and they've been taken as well. But what did you make to Sonny's death?
I mean, I think it made sense because I think that she couldn't live without Jeanette, and that she, I mean, it's not like she, she would have been arrested. It's not like she would have been a part of the child's life anyway. So yeah. I think she didn't see another option, really, that it's not really a second thought to her what she's going to do.
Yeah. The thing about it, you could tell it was going to happen. It was interesting the way that she died, that she actually just fell to her knees and stayed up, which I thought was really effective. I thought that was a really effective way of her dying. And then we also get an effective scene with Peter closing the door, as obviously like, this case is closed now, we've done our bit. And then we get the final part, which is then Frank finding out that Jeanette's family doesn't want to take them, doesn't want to adopt the kid, that social services have said, basically, you can choose whichever way you want, which is a bit suspect to be fair to them.
But yeah, that may have been something where maybe you did need Catherine there to better explain how that placement gets handled. But they're just trying to get to the end here.
Yeah, no, we have to get to the end, don't we? We have to get to the following the path, which is what Frank's been doing all the way through this episode. And they came up and they've never met them. They've never, they even say that in the episode, but when we meet the couple at the house, they say, we pray for all the inmates, you know, but we had strongest feelings for Jeanette. You know, the Lord moves in mysterious ways, and that's when we see Frank with the bullets and looking at the pictures and stuff. And then we kind of have a pullout, just like leaving them as they are, to do what they want to do, that they're going to look after that, that child. And I think that it's a really interesting way of finishing the episode. And I think it's a real humble way and a hopeful ending. So
it makes the, what happened to Jeanette and Sonny, that at least that for their child is going to be in a good home. So yeah. Everything they did wasn't for nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. So that does bring the episode to an end. Is there anything that you feel that I may have missed?
Well, we should mention, since we talked about how good the actresses are, Missy Kreider, who plays Jeanette, she was in the movie Powder with Lance Henriksen.
All right, yeah.
So
that's been a long time since I've seen that.
Right, yeah. But that's one of Lance Henriksen's, I think, bigger roles in a more mainstream movie. So
yeah,
so it's just interesting that they did. I don't know if that had to do with her casting or not, but it is interesting that they working together again.
As I say, I mean, I think both of them, both characters, both actresses, really work well. Thank you very much, Adam, for coming on and doing another episode of The Time Is Now. Where can people find you online?
Well, the Twitter account is XF_lost_episodes. That's the Twitter account for the X-Files virtual season 12 that we did. I don't really have a personal Twitter beyond that.
Yeah, is there any plans of doing a season 13, or are you just sticking with season 12 at the moment?
Well, you know, people ask us, but we haven't. Okay. I don't know. Nothing's being worked on right now, but there's always discussions. There's always a possibility for things. So
you can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at rmuldrake. That's rmuldrake. And you can find me on the Make It So podcast, the Star Trek Universe podcast, and that's at Jean-Luc Poddard. And you'll be able to find me also on the Xcast. I'm sure you'll see me over there as well. Before we go, just remember that you can listen to a few clips of what's been happening on the network just as soon as we finish up here. But again, Adam, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. And until next time, people, remember, this is who we are.
Previously on the We Made This Network. Free with this month's issue.
And also, I wonder if Tim Harrington and Colin have been in the same room together.
I've still got slightly more hair.
Because you go onto the Wikipedia page, and for a moment I thought Colin was wearing a multicoloured feather jacket.
I am. Yeah, I am.
Yeah. If you were on a Skype call, you'd see that.
But, I'm not in Les Savvy Fan.
Cinematory.
A lot of interesting things with that mechanic, couldn't you? I'm sure the sequels probably play into it. Like, if it's not your turn to die, people just jump out of planes and shit and they're fine.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Yeah. Could do, yeah. But again, as a character, would you risk that in case it was your turn? In case there's like some information you didn't know about, someone else has been saved there, for it's your go now.
I mean, if I knew it were going to come eventually, I would absolutely get some knuckle dusters on and fight my way into the White House just with my fist. Just like, I mean, if you're going to go out anyway, just like man in polo neck charges into White House, takes down 300 Secret Service, shits on Donald Trump's face, and kills him by slamming his head in a drawer.
Life's milestones.
So, what do you think? Are we going to go with compostable, Chris?
I like that as an idea. Oh, there's the Hunter S. Thompson firework idea I quite like as well.
What's that?
Had these ashes loaded into a rocket and just shot up in it as a firework.
Amazing.
Whether that's true or not, that's the legend has it. Anyway.
Well, you get quite a lot of ashes. You could have a firework. You could then have some thrown into your garden, or you could then have some in a necklace for somebody else. But you get a lot of ashes, and you don't need a lot of ashes to make...
It's a weird thing. I don't know if I know anyone who's been cremated and then had the ashes. I must do, but I can't imagine having someone's ashes in the house. That feels faintly creepy. I would follow various kind of dog forums on Facebook, and you can get dog ashes. And
I've got my cat's ashes. I've got cat ashes on the mantelpiece.
I can somehow see that more than a fellow human.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.